He doesn't want to remember.
But she was the first student, I don't know, who became ordained as a monk. And she eventually founded the Zen Heart Sangha, meditation center in Menlo Park. That must be 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So she's been a teacher there in Menlo Park for 20 years. Welcome.
Hello
again. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you. So for me, this is like coming home, of course. It's always lovely to see the altar because so many of things that are on the altar I grew up with. They're like the toys you had when you were a little child. Yeah? You remember them. The kobaku and the incenser and the Buddha and even this little carved incense holder. These were all part of my weekly, twice a weekly experience for many, many years. So some things change and some things don't. It's good to have some continuity. So it's very kind of you all to invite me tonight. I'm always happy to be here. I'm always happy to share the Dharma. I'm always happy to see Kondo thriving and to know that my teacher is still here after all these years, every single day, bringing the Dharma to all of us. That is quite an example for all of us. So I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about the practice of non-attachment, not to be confused with detachment. Detachment is quite another thing. But in our practice, non-attachment, it turns out, is a pretty important idea and practice. And there's a very famous poem. It starts this way. There is really nothing you must be. And there is nothing you must do. There is really nothing you must have, and there is nothing you must know. There is really nothing you must become. However, it helps to understand that fire burns, and when it rains, the earth gets wet. Whatever, there are consequences. Nobody is exempt, said the master. Nobody is exempt. These rules apply to everyone. Karma, cause and effect. And the thing is, we may think we're getting away with a lot. That's just because it's not a one-to-one affair. Yeah. Sometimes it is. If I drop this cup, it will probably break. But if I say something mean-spirited to someone, it may be quite a while before I realize the harm that I've caused. And that harm may go on, because that person may then turn around and say something harmful to someone else, and it may be a while before the karma of that, the consequences, come back to me. It seems to me that right now is one of those times in history where We aren't paying very close attention to consequences. It's just all action and no thinking. So the discipline of giving up what is not true in this moment is about non-attachment. It's the leaving behind of this I, me and mine. And it's very hard to do. We can talk about it a lot, but you know, pretty much everything we're doing all day long is about I, me and mine. This is about what you think you have to be, or to do, or to know, or to become. Pretty much 99% of our day is all about me. You know, we joke, oh yes, it's all about me, but actually it is. However, as you practice longer and longer, you begin to understand and actually have experience of cause and effect and the consequences of both action and non-action. You know, a lot of times it's easy to see the consequences of action. It's not so easy to see the causes that are part of non-action. So, for instance, in social justice, one of the ideas is being an upstander, not a bystander. And an upstander is someone who has to do something or not do something. And if you're at the moment that someone needs you to upstand with them that you don't, great harm can happen, and there's that consequence. But the only true thing in each moment is our non-separation from everything. And it's hard to see that because it looks, for instance, like we're all sitting in these separate bodies in this room. But that is the only true thing, actually, that we are not separate. And attachment occurs when we feel separate, when we believe we are separate. Because then I don't have to care about anybody else. I don't have to worry about my actions. I just have to take care of number one, right? So I had kind of a big experience of this last year. After 28 years as the librarian of my school, I decided, because there was a lot of encouragement from my staff, to give up that job, which I loved, and take on something much more complicated, which was to be the assistant director of my school. And for the last year, the person who was my assistant in the library acted as the temporary librarian while I tried out this new position, because there was a chance that the staff after a year would decide they didn't like this position, and because it was new, and that then I would just go back to being librarian. Well, after a year, they decided they'd keep me, and that meant we had to hire a librarian. It turned out to be my assistant, which is wonderful. But that meant that after a year of sort of not doing anything, I had to go back into the library and remove every personal item in there. And after 28 years, I had papered the walls with cards that people had given me that I thought the kids would like, and there were stuffed animals that people had given me, you know, because I teach 3 to 14-year-olds. There were posters on the wall. I can't even remember all the things. But I had to go in and take everything out. It was like this final moment of, guess what? You are no longer the librarian. And you are never going to be again. And it was interesting because even though I said to myself, this is what I want, and I'm going to do this, when I had taken all these cards down, that I had a doorway like this that has a lot of beautiful woodwork because it's an old Victorian building, and there were cards sort of surrounding it on all sides. And when I took it all down, first of all, I thought, oh my goodness, it looks so blank. But then I thought, but that's the point. Because the next librarian who comes in needs to do what they need to do. And you need to get out of the way. And so I highly recommend, after 28 years of doing something, go do something else. You see where your attachments are. You see the opinions you have. Oh dear, she's reading that book? So it was a really important practice experience for me, because I think we all get very attached and identify with our work in the world. And even if our work is volunteer work or it's taking care of our parents, we can get attached to just about anything. So I came across a poem that was not by a Buddhist, but which I thought really spoke to this. It's by the novelist Louise Erdrich, and she writes adult books as well as children's. And it's a lovely poem about the religion of grass. And I'm not talking about the stuff you smoke. She says, I would be converted to a religion of grass. Sleep the winter away and rise headlong each spring. Sink deep roots. Conserve water. Respect and nourish your neighbors, and never let trees get the upper hand. Such are the tenets and the dogmas. As for the practice, grow lush in order to be devoured or caressed. Stiffen in sweet elegance. Invent startling seeds. These also make sense. Bow beneath the arm of fire. Connect underground. Provide. Provide. Be lovely and do not harm. So the first time I read this, I thought, oh, wow, beautiful poem about grass. Then I thought, wait a minute, no. This is about our practice. This is exactly what we're all aspiring to all the time. Sleep the winter away and rise headlong each spring. This is about being ready for anything. You rise headlong. You give each moment your complete energy, your determination, your dedication. We're talking about this all the time, meeting this moment. And it's very hard to meet this moment because we're usually still stuck in the last moment looking forward to the other moment. But to be right here in this moment, meeting each one fresh and sweet. It's like spring every time you turn around. But at the same time, sink deep roots. In other words, we have to start where we are. You know, a lot of people come to Zen practice because something else didn't work out for them. In my case, it was Catholicism. For some people, other things. For some people, they never had any religion in their life, and they're looking for something that qualifies as that. So it's like we're always in that seeking mode. But really, Zen practice is why it's so simple we miss it. It just says, you know what? Stop here. Sit on your cushion for a very long time. Sink deep roots. Start where you are. I remember years ago, not in this building, but in the place where Kanando used to be. We were very fortunate to have Houston Smith come and give a lecture. And for those of you who don't know, Houston Smith was one of the grand masters of theology and religion in the world. He wrote The Religions of Man. And incredible man, very wise. And he studied six major religions in his life. And the way he did it was he spent 10 years with a master in each religion. And Zen was one of them. So he did Christianity, he did Judaism, he did Zen. He finally ended up at the last one I think he did was, I think the last one was Muslim religion, but I think before that, when he had come to Kanado, he had just finished his 10 years of Sufism. And the thing I remember from that night is him saying that he talked to his Sufi master about this. He said, well, am I going about this the wrong way? I mean, you know, I've spent 10 years here and 10 years there, or should I be just spending all my time in one place? And the Sufi master said, you know, you could dig one hole 60 feet deep, or you could dig 10 holes, 6 holes, 10 feet deep. One way or the other, you'll get there. And I remember that night, Les and I think we were like the last people or something, but we walked him out to the curb. And he was driving away, and I remember turning to Les and saying, now, there goes a Zen master. And Les, oh, yeah. He was a very wise person, but I think the thing that he really understood was you can't flit around. You can't go shopping for spirituality. In my case, because of my teacher's example, I just, once I found Zen, it was the place for me. It felt right to me. But sometimes I have students who've been with me a while and it's not seeming to fit. And boy, the first thing I say is, go find the thing that does fit and then go deep. Sink deep roots and then never give up. That's our attachment, is we want it to be easy. We want it to be blissful. And so we start sinking the roots, and then things aren't going so well, and we immediately pull up our roots and rush off in another direction. But it is in the very sinking of the roots, when things are difficult, that true practice arises. So then she says, conserve water. Well, after this last winter, there's a part of me that's, oh my goodness, we don't need to conserve water. I was having flooding at my house. I live at the top of 84, and if you've been up there recently, you know we've had a single lane for months and in several places. So the idea of conserving water, it's like, really? But what it's talking about really is, do not squander the Dharma. Water is life. You know, it's like in the Genjo Koan, the air is life, water is life, the fish is life, the bird is life. Life must be the fish, life must be the bird. Don't squander this practice. Don't take it for granted. Don't take your teacher for granted. He's not going to be here forever. You're not going to be here forever. You never take more than you need, but you always use what you take. So, in Orioki, our eating practice, you know, we have this practice where the food is served and you have to eat everything in your bowls. Because if you don't, at the end, the poor servers have to come and, you know, empty your bowl out. But the idea being is don't take more than you need, but take what you need and then use it completely. This is conserving life. Respect and nourish your neighbors. This is that part. We are not separate. We don't exist in a vacuum. You couldn't have even gotten here tonight without the help of thousands of beings. You got in a car, probably. Or even if you rode a bicycle. Somebody had to make that car. Somebody had to make that bicycle. Somebody had to take it to a store. Somebody had to sell it to you. Somebody had to make roads for you to use it on. I mean, when you start thinking of it that way, there is nothing you do that does not depend on everything else. And so we respect and nourish our neighbors because they make our life possible. In nourishing others, we nourish ourselves. This is the very first thing in the Dhammapada, the Buddha's original teaching says, hatred does not cease by hatred at any time. Hatred ceases by love. This is an unalterable law. And we know how true it is when things get bad. Because whatever else is true, and however much you may shake your head at the news sometimes, because I know I certainly do, when bad things happen, it brings out the best in people. People who probably the day before were arguing politics with each other, or maybe they were in each other's faces, you know, when the hurricane hit, they were there for each other. Because once all that shallow stuff is moved away, our fundamental connection becomes apparent. We are neighbors in the most intimate sense of the word, that we cannot get along without each other. Doesn't matter whether you know, live far away in the country or whether you're in the big city. There is a reliance that we have on everything, not just human beings, but all forms of life. You know, it's the vows that you say at the end, sentient beings are numberless. I vow, you know, to honor them. That's what we do. This is a great line, though. Never let trees get the upper hand. So if you're grass, you're at the bottom of the peg. Trees are up above you. So it's important to understand that Zen practice does not expect you to be a rug and everybody steps on you. You know, that's not true humility. You need to stand up for yourself. No matter how small or unimportant you may think you are, you have a right to be who you are. And who you are is enough. It's a real problem in our society, I think, that we're always being told that we're not enough. We're not rich enough. We're not beautiful enough. We're not thin enough. We're not young enough. Which is a real problem, because the only people who fall into those categories are like 18 forever. And we're not. I wouldn't go back to being 18 for all the tea in China. I like who I have become. And I stand up for my right to be so. But there are so many people that suffer this belief that if they only had this, or they could only do that, or if they could only be this other thing. But remember that poem, there is nothing you must become. You must just be completely grass, or completely tree, or completely whatever it is you are. But at the same time, here's the however, you have to allow everything to exist on a level playing field. In other words, you have to meet each person, each thing, and each situation as equal. This is the beginning of tolerance. And our practice shows us this is that part of no separation also. But if I'm so attached to me, what I'm going to tend to do is always want to be different and special and somehow separate from you. Instead of wanting to find our commonality and find out what I have in common with you, I'm going to want to mitigate your affairs and who you are so that I can raise myself. But it's a false kind of raising. You know, if I have to put others down in order to bring myself up, great suffering is going to ensue, because The thing you find out, hopefully early on, is there will always be somebody richer than you are, someone smarter than you, someone more beautiful, someone wiser, someone kinder, someone who has a better temper than you do. I mean, I know that's true of me. If I spent my whole life worrying about that, I could never let go of suffering. So you have to stand up for yourself. You don't let the trees get the upper hand, but you become completely grass, and that's enough. So then you grow lush in order to be devoured or caressed. I love this because, you know, grass is both something that animals in particular eat, but it's also, I mean, even in the drought, people are still growing grass in their yards. Why is this? Because it's so nice to walk on, right? Children love to play on it, so it caresses us. So it's both food and sensual pleasure at the same time. But the point is, grow lush in order to be devoured or caressed, that you grow lush. You grow rich in your you-ness. You know, there's this great story about the king who has the horse trainer. And every time he turns around, he's got a lame horse. And he can't understand why every time he gets a new trainer, or gets a new horse, the horse goes lame. Until he finally goes down and he meets his new trainer. The trainer is lame. And the horses have been learning it from the trainer. So, you're not here to become less. You're not here to become each other. You are here to become absolutely and completely you. But when that happens, all of your ideas and opinions and ego about you fall away. So a lot of times what you'll notice about people who are really extraordinary is that in a way they're really quite ordinary. They've let go of all idea of them being extraordinary. So for many years I didn't understand this about my tea teacher, Peg. You know, from any other buddy's point of view, she was just a very ordinary old woman. But she wasn't. She was really quite extraordinary. But she just didn't think of herself as extraordinary. And so she was able to completely be herself, which allowed everyone around her to be completely themselves. She was, just by her example of being completely herself, she was able to help us be more that way. So once you become totally you, then you can stop worrying about you. It's really quite wonderful, you know. It's what Dogen says. He says, you know, to study the way is to study the self. And to study the self is to forget the self. And then to forget the self is to manifest the 10,000 things. So, once you forget yourself, you can just give yourself away. But you never actually lose anything. You know, you're just this endless channel of energy going through you and out to other people. So the only thing I wish that Dogen had said, just later on, was that first part where he says, you know, to study the way is to study the self for a very long time. You cannot forget the self quickly. It's really quite hard to do. And just when you think you have, you find out that now you're attached to, oh yes, I've forgotten myself. You just become attached to a different thing. So this is why our practice is not something we just do for a day or a month or even a year, that, you know, we do it the rest of our life. It's not a self-improvement program. It's every single day we sit down on our cushion and we keep clarifying and we keep dropping away these ideas we have of who we think we are and who we think everybody else is. Because it's all just opinion and assumption and delusion. Because we don't actually know. So then our grass is to stiffen in sweet elegance. This is about sitting up straight, or on your chair, sitting up straight, or on your cushion. You know, in Zen practice, we make a big deal out of posture. There's a reason for that. That, you know, the whole body and mind are not separate. So if you sit leaning over like this, your mind is also leaning over like this. But when you sit in this beautiful posture, with a slightly curved back and the shoulders thrown back, there's a strength in this. This is that stiffening in sweet elegance. You know, when you sit up like this, your diaphragm has space to move, and your lungs are now, because you've thrown your shoulders back a little, your lungs have more space. So what they're finding, surprise, surprise, is that people who have meditated for long periods of time have great health, generally. And they have really good mental health, but they also have incredible physical health. And this is partly because we are practicing this sitting up straight and breathing deeply and being quiet for long periods of time. And then when we walk in Kinhin, again, we're not just sort of, you know, shambling along. We're standing in a very particular posture. And we have our hands in chashu. And they are up here. They're not just hanging loose at our side. We're actually very intentional about our walking. And we're combining our breathing with the movement of our feet. As we exhale, the foot comes down. So this is both a mindfulness practice, but it is also a way of being aware of the body in this elegant stiffness. But then there's this wonderful line that we invent startling seeds. To me, this is what comes from practice. You do your daily practice on your cushion, and you must do that. And when you don't do it, you realize it. It only takes a day or two. I mean, you know, the Zazen bank empties quickly. You can put a little deposit here and there, but, you know, you can't take too much out. So you do your daily practice. You sit every morning or every night. But that allows you to go out in the world and invent startling seeds, to go out and create something beautiful. Whether it is a relationship, or a piece of art, or a new computer program, or a road, or taking care of a child. Maybe it's gardening. Whatever it is for you, to go out and make this world more beautiful, more useful, more kind. To be passionate about whatever you do, whatever you go out to do. You get to reinvent yourself moment after moment, because one thing that comes out of Zen practice is you realize there's no you. There's this thing that we provisionally call myself, but actually in each moment you're beginning anew. There's a new you. It's just that the moments are so close together that they allied, and so it feels like there's a constant you. But I'm pretty sure that when you sit down in Zazen and you do it for long periods of time, like in a sesshin, you begin to see that this thing that you call yourself is really quite porous and nebulous, and you really can't put your finger on it. But because of that, I mean, this is great news. It means you can change. You know? And there's this great line in one of the Thich Nhat Hanh books where Thich Nhat Hanh is talking to a mother, and she's kind of bemoaning, you know, how everything changes. It's just terrible. But her daughter sort of tugs on her. She's standing there while Thich Nhat Hanh is talking to her. She says, "But Mommy, if there was no change, I couldn't grow up." Yes. Change is inevitable, but it is also wonderful. And even when it seems terrible, even when you don't want something to change, I don't know, my experience usually is that if I can just be patient, something comes out of it that was necessary for me, maybe for others. So there's a wonderful statement by the writer of Peter Pan, Sir James Barrie. He says, "Those who bring light and love to others cannot keep it from themselves." When you finally let go of this one and you start living for service to others, that's exactly what happens. You just start bringing light and love to everyone to the best of your ability, and you screw up all the time too. And so sometimes you're not bringing light and love, and well, okay. But the point is to try and cause the least amount of harm possible. You're going to cause harm, so you can accept that. But you can also try to bring that light and love and that passion to whatever it is that you do every day. A little passion on the road wouldn't go amiss, actually, of forgiving each other for being in a hurry. Then she says, "Bow beneath the arm of fire." This is an admonition. You have to remember impermanence. First come the rains in Southern California. Then everything grows like crazy. And then come the fires. I grew up in Southern California. This was a cycle that repeated itself over and over again. There is going to be fire. There is going to be regrowth. There's going to be another fire. Then there's going to be a flood, and then there's going to be more growth. This is impermanence. You are not actually in control. So you have to bow to difficulty. Just don't break. You have to be like bamboo. Or redwoods, actually. In the 1989 earthquake, I was watching outside my window, and the redwoods were going way this way and way that way, and I kept expecting them to break, but they don't. And like bamboo, they can go very far. It takes a lot to break bamboo. I don't know if you've ever tried just to do it, break it with your hand. It's really hard to do. So you can bend a long way with your difficulty, but you're going to have to bow to it. You're going to have to make friends with it. You're going to have to accept difficulty, because nobody is exempt, just like the Master said. But the good news, you get to connect underground. Probably near the beginning of my practice, I don't remember where I read this exactly, but there was a line that said, "The best gift is given in stealth." I have always loved this. I mean, don't you like receiving a gift that you have no idea who it's from? It just sort of shows up? Or something in your mailbox that you weren't expecting with no, you know, just something. To give a gift in stealth means that you are not attached to needing gratitude. You are not attached to needing to be seen. So you come here on a Saturday and you see something that needs to be done, and you just do it. And you don't worry about who sees you do it or whether somebody even noticed that you did it. And you do it because it needs to be done. And in fact, sometimes it's sweeter when you don't know. Nobody knows that you did it. It's just something you know. I have a little sign that I took out of the Buddha Dharma magazine a long time ago. It was an article on Buddhist sayings from the Lojong. And it's my favorite one. It says, "Don't expect applause." How many times are we waiting for people to say, "Oh, good job," or "Oh, that was great"? But that's not why we did it, right? We didn't do it because we were waiting for the applause. We do it because it's the right thing to do. And then provide. Provide. Be generous. Be kind. Be supportive whenever you can. There's this idea in practice, but we don't talk about it very much, to commit our life to service. We talk about this thing that we do when we offer incense and vows as service. But actually the true service that you are doing is coming here, is sitting, is settling the self on the self. Because then you take it back out there, which, believe me, is invaluable. Nobody, you can't put a price. It's like the Genjo Koan says, you know, you can't measure it. It's vast beyond the sands of the Ganges. One person, the merit of one person saw them. So the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore says, I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I acted, and behold, service was joy. Life as service. Service as joy. I think most of us came to practice because we wanted more, we wanted our life to mean something. We wanted to find meaning of this gift that we've been given that sometimes seems very difficult, and you know, especially as we get older and things aren't working as well, and what am I doing here? What I am doing is being of service. There's a Tibetan teacher, apparently the first thing he thinks of in the morning is, how can I be of service today? I wish it was my first thought. Unfortunately, my first thought is usually, oh my goodness, my alarm's going off. But maybe it could be your second thought, or maybe even your third. How can I be useful today? How can I be helpful? And finally, be lovely and do not harm. To be lovely is to be both loving and loved. Acting from that place of love is a state of being lovely. And so we have our three pure precepts. Do no harm. Practice all good. Save all beings. Pretty hard. Kind of a lot to ask. And we're going to fail. Every day we're going to fail. But we don't give up. I mean, I have to say, if there is nothing else I learned from our teacher, it was perseverance and determination. Never, ever give up. No matter how you've screwed things up, no matter how harmful you have been, or stupid, or confused, or deluded, it will pass. Never give up. Go back to your cushion. Live that life of service. Be lovely and do no harm. So the founder of my school, Peninsula School, and also of Hidden Villa, was Josephine Duveneck, a very amazing person. And she said, becoming aware of the relationships of all living things to other living things is the key to knowing ourselves. It is the basis for understanding the intricate web of life. Understanding the web of life is the beginning of the end of suffering. And that is how we save all beings. That is how we bring joy and passion and beauty into our lives. It's actually how we return to ourselves and completely inhabit this one without being attached to it. And so finally, one of those things that I took off my wall at the library was a little short poem by Raymond Carver. And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so? I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved. To feel myself beloved on the earth. This, I think, is what we all want. We want to be beloved and we want to love. But in order to do that, we have to let go of this small self that's always clamoring for attention. We need to learn how to be of service to others without forgetting how to stand up for ourselves too. So please, be lovely and do no harm. Thank you.